With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Explaining History podcast, and today I want to talk about the relationship between Louis George and Nazi Germany later in Louis George's life, in the second part of the 1930s, and it's an episode which has attracted a great deal of controversy over the years, and the question as to Louis George's judgment following the end of the Second World War has been widely debated. I think it's worth looking at things through a kind of the prism of, and not necessarily objectivity, but trying not to look at things from a post Second World War perspective, which is easy for us to do. We know what happened. The reality in 1936, when Lloyd George is making overtures towards Nazi Germany, is that his position of engagement with Germany is broadly supported by Parliament, and that the those that cry appeasement later on at Chamberlain, the likes of obviously Winston Churchill, are in the minority and considered to be out of step and considered to be on the wrong side of history. Now, events would prove Churchill correct, but in 1936-1937, he was certainly far from being a figure at the heart of politics, and seen as a kind of quite a marginal voice in Parliament. So it's important to look at what Lloyd George was doing in context. Not for a moment so I'm arguing that engagement with Hitler on any level was in any way justifiable. Far from it. Anyway, let's go into into examining this. Now, tonight I'm working from Lloyd George, Statesman or Scoundrel by Richard Wilkinson, sent to me by my good friends at IB Tourist, plug there, and it's an interesting all-round biography of Lloyd George, and it talks about this rather... this kind of the duality of him. Statesman or Scoundrel? Well, kind of both, really. Now, I don't intend to do a kind of a full biography of Lloyd George, because obviously trying to get that one into 25 minutes is very difficult. But Statesman or Scoundrel by Richard Wilkinson is definitely for anyone that is interested in the First World War, interested in the Liberal Party and the People's Budget, and interested in the messy and ugly compromises at the end of the war with the Paris Peace Conference, and everything that Lloyd George does between 1918 and 1923, including his involvement in the the Greco-Turkish War, the first real kind of bloodbath to embrace Europe outside of Poland and Russia after the First World War, it's really, really worth examining. By 1931, and the establishment of the national government, in which Ramsay MacDonald and Chancellor Philip Snowden were the only members of the Labour Front bench in a government almost exclusively made up of Conservatives, both of them were later expelled from the Labour Party for forming a national government with the Tories. Lloyd George at that time is, like Churchill, a figure in the wilderness. His health hadn't been that great. In August 1931, he'd had a prostate operation. And all attempts to reintroduce himself to national politics failed. What remains of the Liberal Party saw him as kind of something of an embarrassment, and he was disliked immensely by the three most significant figures of the national government: Ramsay MacDonald, Stanley Baldwin, and Neville Chamberlain. And even his friendship with Churchill starts to fray. Churchill, by this point, having defected to the Conservative Party. And it's interesting to think of Churchill, because Churchill's own fate after the war, firstly in opposition, and secondly then back in government, being gradually undermined by the likes of Anthony Eden, mirrors in the 1950s what happened to Lloyd George in the 1930s. Both men had been at the height of their powers as warlords, really, as wartime prime ministers with vast, almost quasi kind of autocratic powers in some cases, to meet the challenge of world war and a struggle for national survival. And thereafter, they go into decline. The Liberal Party, which had also divided between the two figures of Sir John Simon and Sir Herbert Samuel, both of whom had vacated the national government, it was an unwelcome home for Lloyd George, having been he had blotted his copybook many times during the First World War and during the period of the first coalition with the Conservatives. There was always the suspicion from the Tories and the Liberals that Lloyd George was going to attempt to steal a chunk of both of their parties and establish some kind of third party in the centre ground of politics in a coup to destroy both of them. And whilst this never happens, there's always a suspicion that it might. What seems to be the case is that Lloyd George seemed to have lost his almost supernatural instinct for politics and for political manoeuvring. And once that had gone, it doesn't return. He was in, obviously, we've said, questionable health, but mentally he seems to have been kind of compos mentis. He eventually suffers from dementia, but that is in the last few months of his life, in 1945. And in the early 1930s, he is still kind of all there. He spent a lot of time on his estate at Churt, doing farming, and devoting himself to solutions to the Great Depression. radical interventionism in the economy, such as what was being seen in America with Roosevelt's Great Depression, and even being proposed by the likes of Oswald Mosley, who, before he formed the British Union of Fascists, formed the New Party in 1931 and proposed the Mosley Manifesto, which was sufficiently economically radical, involving state intervention in the economy and state direction of the economy in the interests of the majority of the population, that it was even backed by the likes of Aaron Bevin. In 1935, Lloyd George launched the Council of Action for Peace and Reconstruction, which was a think tank to suggest state interventionist ideas on the lines of the New Deal, but this was roundly dismissed by the cabinet. The cabinet had been committed to austerity policies not dissimilar to the ones that Britain currently experiences. The reason for this was that following the end of the First World War, Britain owed an immense amount of debt to America, particularly to Wall Street banks. The debt, repayable in pounds, needed to be serviced, and this meant that Britain's kind of economic leeway in terms of spending on the British economy was limited, not because there were Wall Street bankers saying, "Why are you spending money on social welfare before paying us back?" Though that was obviously something that they did say. But because any increase in taxation in order to pay for social welfare affected the value of the pound itself. Whilst the pound was on the gold standard at the beginning of the 1930s, the gold standard wasn't completely fixed and could be adjusted based on the level of interest in investment in the British economy. And the result was that American banks did not wish to see one of their creditors spending lots of money. And there was always the threat that there would be a run on the pound, that American banks would simply sell Britain's debt and sell any pound, any sterling holdings they might have. And this left Britain beholden to Wall Street. So Lloyd George's ideas, his New Deal sort of notions, were unlikely to get off the ground. The crisis that presented Lloyd George with an opportunity was the Italian invasion of Abyssinia and the secret machinations of Samuel Hoare and Pierre Laval, the British and French diplomats who drew up the Hoare-Laval Pact, which essentially enabled Mussolini in his quest to seize Abyssinia. Richard Wilkinson writes on this subject: Lloyd George, however, erupted like a volcano after the outbreak of the Abyssinia crisis in October 1935. The government failed to implement an effective policy against Mussolini's pursuit of an African empire. Half-hearted economic sanctions were applied, but only too soon abandoned. The Mediterranean fleet could have blocked the Suez Canal, thus spoiling Mussolini's game, but a mad dog attack by the Italian Air Force on British ships was feared, so once again, nothing was done. A craven decision, especially when one recalls the abysmal record of the Italian armed forces in the Mediterranean 5 years later. Eden, the League of Nations specialist, was dispatched to Geneva to tell the League that Britain could no longer offer effective support. Half a league, half a league, half a league onward into the valley of death, quipped the cynics.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Such cynicism was taken a stage further when the foreign ministers of Britain and France conferred in Paris to produce the Hoare-Laval Pact, whereby Mussolini was invited to accept the more desirable parts of Abyssinia if he called off his army, now employing poison gas against the indigenous tribesmen. The outcry in Britain was deafening, led by George V, who greeted Hoare when he resigned with seals of office somewhat heartlessly. "Do you know what they are saying, or they were saying? No more coals to Newcastle, no more Hoares to Paris." Both pact and foreign secretary were disowned, while Hitler exploited his potential enemy's disarray by remilitarising the Rhineland in March 1936. On the 18th of June 1936, it was announced that Anthony Eden, now Foreign Secretary, would report to Geneva that the government had abandoned economic sanctions as they were clearly not working, whereupon Lloyd George tore into the government, delivering what Churchill called the finest parliamentary oration he had ever heard. It was certainly an effective mugging job, though maybe the right way out of the Abyssinia crisis was not quite so simple as Lloyd George seemed to believe. This is Lloyd George. "I cannot imagine a more serious debate than that which we are going through now. If the policy of the government is to materialise, if we are going to Geneva to say, we are beaten, the League has failed, we do not propose any further sanctions, believe me, that is an end to the authority of the League of Nations." The Foreign Secretary referred this afternoon to the well-ordered ranks of the League. "They have not broken away, and he is not going there now to break them. He is going to Geneva to smash the League of Nations. This is a unique occasion. I have been in the House for nearly half a century. I am sorry to say, and I cannot recall an occasion quite like this. I have never before heard a British minister come down to the House of Commons and say that Britain was beaten. Here is the resolute aim. Here is the resolute footstep running away." The speech of the Chancellor of the Exchequer has been quoted. I am going to do myself the honour of reading part of it again. And he quotes, "The choice before us is whether we should make a last effort at Geneva for peace and security, or whether by a cowardly surrender we should break all the promises we have made and hold ourselves up to the shame of our children and our children's children. Tonight we have a cowardly surrender, and there are the cowards." So a fine piece of speech-making, though, as the author suggests, perhaps slightly disingenuous, as we shall see. So the condemnation that Lloyd George reserves for the British government and their dealings with Mussolini is slightly at odds with his later treatment of Hitler. Up until the outbreak of the Second World War, Lloyd George had sympathies for Nazi Germany. And I'm not suggesting that Lloyd George was in any way fascist or racist in his outlook at all. not what I mean by sympathies. But he was sympathetic towards Germany and harboured views that Britain had humiliated Germany, along with the French and the Americans at Versailles, and that if they wound up with a revanchist regime, as they certainly did with the Nazis, then it was hardly surprising. Lloyd George had, throughout the 1920s, seen opportunities to be, in some cases, unduly sympathetic towards Weimar Germany, despite how we see it in black and whites. Weimar Germany had little interest in keeping up full reparations repayments, still had territorial ambitions in the east after the signing of the Locarno Treaties in 1925. There was the quiet abandonment by the British and the French of commitments towards Czechoslovakia and Poland, and the democratic Weimar government knew this full well and intimated strongly that it may wish to rearrange those borders at some point in the near future. So there was a great sympathies that Lloyd George had towards Weimar Germany's rights to gradually dismantle aspects of the Treaty of Versailles. And these sympathies don't really end when Hitler comes to power in January 1933. Hitler had previously spoken highly of Lloyd George. He had mentioned him in Mein Kampf. He had said, "The primitive quality of those speeches, the originality of his expression, his choice of pure and simple illustration, are examples which prove the superior political capacity of this." And here where we see Hitler's basic ignorance. He refers to Lloyd George as an Englishman. Obviously he's not, he's Welsh, he's from Wales, and the idea that Great Britain is a multi-ethnic society with different distinct nations within it was probably lost on Hitler himself. He was highly provincial in his outlook. Hitler put out the feelers to see if Lloyd George might visit Germany, and Lloyd George's vanity and ego were definitely stroked by this. And the fact that the British government had rejected Lloyd George's state interventionist ideas, and at first glance it looked like these sorts of ideas were being embraced in Germany, was an excellent reason for the for Lloyd George to go and see his, as he saw it, his concepts in action, and for his wounded ego to be nursed by the Nazi regime. Lloyd George set off for Bavaria to go to the Berghof in September 1936. By this point, of course, the Rhineland has been remilitarised, the Nuremberg Laws have been passed the year before that, and the SA has been brutally murdered, its leadership brutally murdered, in 1934. All of this is public knowledge, and Lloyd George had to really turn a blind eye in order to continue with the trip. And the conveyor of the invite was none other than Joachim von Ribbentrop, who by 1936 was Hitler's ambassador to London, and Germany making a very poor job of trying to draw Britain into a full alliance with Nazi Germany. And there is the odd spectacle of the two men lavishing praise on one another over lunch, and gradually the real reason for the meeting emerges. Hitler attempts to present himself to Lloyd George as being eminently reasonable, a man who wished to have friendly relations with the British Empire, and wished to reassure, to show that Germany would be a good neighbour in Europe, as long as Germany, of course, was unable to make certain changes in Europe without being unduly bothered by anybody else. Hitler seems to have known exactly how to speak to Lloyd George in order to get a favourable response. He said famously that the war had been won due to one statesman, a great statesman, yourself, Mr. Lloyd George. It was you who rallied the people and gave them the determination for victory. If I, instead of being one of many millions of German private soldiers, had been in the position of a leader instead of being subject at any time to have been shot, even by black troops, matters would have been very different. I'm convinced that if I had been in power then, I could have prevented Germany's downfall. Astonishing that Hitler, even in that little oration, manages to inject some racism into the conversation. He had sold Lloyd George on Germany's intentions, however, at the end of the meeting. And Lloyd George came away believing that Hitler was an immense admirer and a devotee of the British Empire, and that Hitler saw the British Empire as essential to maintaining some kind of racial stability in the world. And of course, there were the obligatory visits to various sites and farms and factories and workshops around the new Germany to show how Nazism was supposedly working. But Lloyd George is really in a hurry to get home to start his new role as an advocate for Nazi Germany, extolling the virtues of peaceful, good relations, and that the George Washington of Germany, as he refers to him, or Germany's resurrection and light, could be trusted to be a good friend to Great Britain. He wrote gushing articles in the Daily Express and the News Chronicle. These were not given a free pass by Lloyd George's critics and by the population at large, as the knowledge of concentration camps and anti-Semitism was widespread. And there's an interesting detail in The Morbid Age by Richard Overy, which I know is a book I've referred to many times, where he does a kind of statistical analysis of newspaper coverage in 1933, and shows that the way in which newspapers reported Nazi Germany and the way in which audiences read about Nazi Germany was overwhelmingly negative, that the vast majority of the population had an immensely dim view of Nazi Germany, and that people like apologists for Hitler, like Lloyd George and obviously Edward VIII, were not very well received. And as overall, a positive view of the Soviet Union was far more likely in the press and in public opinion during that time. Anyway, I'll finish there, but the kind of the takeaway here really is that Lloyd George in his later years, marginalised from power but desperate to have significance again, was easily seduced by Hitler, who understood probably that Lloyd George required flattery. Perhaps Hitler was a genuine admirer, and that in return for that, Lloyd George would become a useful advocate. Okay, so if you want to catch more of the explaining history content, why not check out our Patreon page? There's some original long-form journalism there. I'll be adding some more pretty soon. You can sponsor us, obviously, every little helps. And I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks, all the best, bye-bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.